today is Carol W. Lindsay. He's a man who, I think more than any other single man, can be credited here in the Bay Area with pioneering magnetic tape recording. He started out with Ampex as a consultant, and now, many, many years later, he is a corporate consultant for Ampex. He was born in San Diego, and when he was about 8, his family moved to the Bay Area. And this is where he grew up. As you know, in this course, the title of it being Men of Impossible Dreams, we are concentrating on our local Bay Area pioneers. Carol Lindsay went to high school here and was always interested in electricity and chemistry. In high school, he was president of his science club. After graduating, he went to work to help his father support their family, and he continued his education whenever he could at Cal Berkeley, where he took engineering courses, mathematics, and so on. He, in his spare time, developed a hobby which is still, it became his life work and still is, and it's hard to say where the hobby and the work begin and end, and that is in high quality reproduction of sound. In 1946, he heard his first magnetic tape recorder, and there began a dream for him. That is what he wanted to do with his life, is to develop that kind of high, he wanted to develop a high quality reproduction system that people could have, accessible, industry could have. He could see far into the future, farther than perhaps anyone at that time in the Bay Area was looking. He did go join Ampex shortly after hearing his first tape recorder as the first project engineer for the development of tape recording. In fact, I really feel in talking to him and in talking to the founder of Ampex, Alexander Poniatoff, that it was Harold Lindsay who really talked Poniatoff into taking up this as a product for his company after World War II. In 1967, Lindsay joined the group of men here at the Foothill College Space Science Center and helped organize the advisory board and the whole program for the center. And those were men at those, in those days, with what many would have considered an impossible dream. There just wasn't the money. There was the dream, but not the money to go forward. The Parham Foundation and other people were dedicated in establishing an electronics museum. The college itself had stated that they had a goal of developing a whole space science center, and the museum was to be one of its first and important parts. So Harold Lindsay joined these other dreamers, and you are now in the building that they dreamed of and that they worked long and hard and had many long evenings and discussions. And he actually, in a very concrete way, I'm sure, was responsible for Ampex donating $25,000 to the Space Science Center. So in every way, this building stands as a partial monument to Harold Lindsay, as well as to the other inventors and developers in the Bay Area. It's with great pleasure today that I present Harold Lindsay, who will tell you the story of his life far better than I've been able to in a very brief way here. Harold Lindsay.
It's indeed a pleasure to be able to participate in this, the final session of your course, and I'll try and give you some highlights of the rather interesting and exciting background of the history of Ampex. Like so many of the electronic firms here on the peninsula, it had a rather unusual startup and some exciting times in its early days. And I'm going to have to jump around in space and time during the presentation of this material, I hope you'll bear with me with this in order to bring the various threads of fate, if you might call it that, together that wove into a picture that made a successful multimillion-dollar corporation. Let us start first with Ampex as a wartime company and the reason for its startup in the first place. It was founded in 1944 during the war years for a specific war need. It seems that Dalmo Victor, with whom I am sure you're all familiar, those of you here are certainly from the Peninsula area, I think, Dalmo Victor found itself with a contract that had just been awarded. Actually, it was a subcontract from the Sperry Gyroscope Company to produce some portions of the APS-6 airborne radar. And it seems that Sperry produced the electronic portions of this radar and the mechanical, if we may call it that, the parabolic dish antenna and some of the drive systems associated with it were part of the subcontract that Dalmo Victor had bid upon and received. Apparently, someone there had made the mistake not to read all the fine print, because when they got the contract, they found there were some challenging matters there with respect to procurement of components. And in particular, two small permanent magnet motors and a permanent magnet AC generator. It seemed that in shopping around to procure these, they couldn't find any takers throughout the country, and they were left in the predicament of not being able to procure all of the necessary components to satisfy the contract. Tomlinson I. Mosley, the then president of Dalmo and its founder, finally, in desperation, came to Alexander M. Poniatoff, a close friend of his, who had had a lot of experience in the design of motors and generators, to get his advice as to what he thought should be done. So they, in turn, turned to a Dr. Huber at Stanford University, professor of electrical engineering, who is there to this day, I believe. And after consulting with him, the final decision was that the only way out to satisfy the rather tight specs on these motors and generators was to set up a company of their own to produce these for Dalmo Victor's need and the contract. So it was decided that Mr. Poniatoff and Mr. Mosley would join 50-50 in this project, and they each put up $25,000, which was required to get the tooling and the company facility set up. And they found a piece of vacant real estate on Old County Road in Belmont. It had been housing in the past a machine shop, and it was in that location that the first work was done. They hired their first engineer, Myron Stolaroff, who was a young graduate in electrical engineering from Stanford, and he, working along with Dr. Huber as a consultant, came up with the designs for the motors and generators. Now, I have a couple of these here as samples, and I'd like to pass them around. But before I do so, I would like to suggest that you exercise some care in handling these if you're wearing a wristwatch or have a pocket watch nearby, because they are strong permanent magnet devices and there's quite a bit of stray field, and you would probably be a bit disturbed to find your watch misbehaving if you got it too close to them. Excuse me. There were two motors, very similar in appearance. Actually, I can't tell one from the other. It probably doesn't matter whether this was a pump, so-called pump motor, which drove a pressurizing pump to compensate for the high altitude at which these the aircraft operated and which this radar was used, Or it could have been the tilt motor, which was used to tilt the parabolic dish on the aircraft's radar. But nevertheless, this is representative of both types, and I'll pass this around so you can get an idea of what Ambex's first products were. The other unit was used in conjunction with the radar as a to generate a synchronizing voltage. It synchronized the scope sweep with mechanical motion. And this is a two-phase generator, and also is a permanent magnet energized device. Now these turned out very successfully and served the contract needs, and there were repeat orders, and Ampex grew, and it finally outgrew the original location. And at a time when space became critical, they couldn't find another suitable location, so Mr. Mosley suggested that they move into the top floor area of the old Dalma Victor building that was located in San Carlos. So they went and moved into the fourth floor there, operated there for a number of months, and finally outgrew that area. And that time they decided to buy a piece of property on Howard Avenue, 1155 Howard, just half a block off of El Camino, and they built a concrete block building there of about 9,000 square feet. And I'll pass some pictures around showing you that. This photograph, which we'll pass around, shows the building looking relatively north on, or northeast on Howard Avenue towards the bay and El Camino. Of interest to you, I think, is this object here just behind this power pole, which happens to be the steam locomotive on an SP train on its way to San Francisco, which is reminiscent of another era of history of the peninsula. This view is taken looking in the opposite direction of the building at dusk, and here we see the generator, and I'll go into the details of this part of the photograph later. It happens to be one of our first attempts at recording. Now, that was about 1945. I have one or two other photographs that should accompany that. Here we have the vacuum impregnating compartment where the stators of these generators and the armatures of the motors were vacuum impregnated with an insulating varnish, which is a mil spec requirement. And this is done in vacuum, and this is where that was conducted. And here we have some of the pictures of the machine shop, which appeared very primitive and small compared to our present-day facility. Now, the main concern of Ampex near the end of the war, Mr. Poniatowski's founder particularly, and also Mr. Mosley, his co-partner, was what would they do at the end of the war when these contracts would expire and they would be left without orders for the product they were producing? Well, they could fold the company up for one thing and say it had served its purpose, but it was going along so nicely they felt, wouldn't it be fine if we could find a post-war product that would enable us to stay in business? So they were looking for possibilities. Now, of course, their facilities and the experience of their people suited the operation best to light electrical manufacturing. So they had in mind a number of things. One of them was possibility of building studio turntables for record reproduction for radio and also record manufacturers' checking requirements. Now, About this time, I was in the engineering department of Dalmo Victor, having come down to the peninsula from the Manhattan Project, in which I was engaged during the war at the University of California. And my good friend Charles Vincent Litton, who just passed away this past fall, had Litton Engineering Laboratories at that time on the peninsula. And he had asked me to come down here from the East Bay to take charge of his high vacuum engineering operation. And since it appeared that the Manhattan Project would certainly fold up, it seemed, after the war, and we saw this in view, I welcomed the opportunity for a job in a challenging area and with such an inspiring person as a boss. And so I accepted and came down, but after having been there but a few months, one night a tragic fire, some of you may remember this, burned down all of the laboratories out on Eaton Avenue. And he had insurance which covered the salaries of his engineering people for 90 days, but the losses were too great beyond that, so that all of us in engineering remained for those 90 days helping to clean up the mess and trying to get salvage something that he could work with, and then we had to look around for other employment. And at that time, I found employment in the engineering department of Dalmo Victor. So it was there that I was occupied one day in design work when a gentleman came by my desk and introduced himself as Forrest Smith. He said, "I happen to be the general manager of Ampex." And I said, "Oh, you're the people who make these small motors and generators that I see about the place." "Yes," he said, "we're just up the next block from here." And so that was all in that conversation. And on successive weeks, he would get through our engineering department, and on most occasions he would stop by and we would have a few moments chat. And he seemed to dwell very often on matters pertaining to audio, asking questions when he found that I had had a background in that field. I was beginning to become curious as to why he was questioning on matters of audio. So one day he finally said, "I've been talking to our founder, Mr. Poniatoff, about you, and we feel we would like to have some assistance from you if you'd care to set up an arrangement with us where you could serve as a consultant for us. And we'd like you to advise us on a post-war product. As you know, our contracts are coming to a close, and we'd like to remain in business." So the arrangements were made, and I went one afternoon after the close of the day at Dalmo and met for the first time Mr. Poniatoff. And this indeed was quite an experience, meeting such an unusual individual. Incidentally, the name Ampex was derived from taking Mr. Poniatoff's initials, AMP, and adding EX to it for excellence of product. And that EX has been quite meaningful, I must say, through the years, because it's ever remained there as a symbol or a philosophy of life, a way of life in the company, to try and achieve excellence. We haven't always been as successful in this as we might like to have been, but nevertheless it was a goal, and I think for that reason it has been a very helpful one towards the success of the company. As a result of that first afternoon's discussion, I was arrangements were made for my time on a part-time basis to meet regularly for a period of some weeks and to go over all of the things that they had been discussing and thinking about, and also examining the company in detail as to its facilities, its capabilities, the backgrounds of its people and their skills and so forth, to try and analyze what would fit best in that picture with the greatest chance of success. Well, previous to that, I had had an experience some months before. Now, in order to explain that experience, I must go back in time and space to another area, and if you'll bear with me, well, we'll divert from the Ampex story for a few moments to pick up another thread of this background. In the latter part of World War II, our forces finally got into Paris, and one of the major activities there was the examination of captured enemy electronic gear. And a person very active in that was a Jack Mullen from the San Francisco area. Actually, Jack Mullen was a graduate in electrical engineering at the University of Santa Clara, and just before the war had been working for Pacific Telephone Company in engineering work in San Francisco. He found himself assigned to this activity first in England and then later in France, of examining captured enemy equipment as one of its functions. And the German magnetophone came to his attention, and he was very much impressed with the mechanical design of it, and a very good tape motion, freedom of from wow and flutter. But the early models that he had the opportunity to examine left something to be desired so far as electronic performance was concerned. In other words, the signal-to-noise ratio was about that of shellac disc. The distortion was about the same, maybe not as good. And the dynamic range, the frequency response was satisfactory. But they just didn't impress him too deeply. Well, in some of his later experiences, he met a British officer who told him about an unusual recorder, which seemed to also be a magnetophone, which was in use in Frankfurt in the broadcasting there, that was being conducted by our Armed Forces Radio Service. When we got in and captured the Frankfurt radio installation, it was taken intact without being damaged, and our Armed Forces Radio Service took over its operation. In fact, they kept the same German crew who were first captive, but were required to run the station under the direction of our officer. And it was in this station that they had some of the later models of the German magnetophone embodying high-frequency bias. It seems that the early models that Jack Mullen examined were of the older type using DC bias, so you can understand why he wasn't too favorably impressed, those of you who are familiar with magnetic tape recording. So, on one of his field tours, he was very close to Radio Frankfurt one day, he and a fellow officer, and they came to a fork in the road, and they had to make the decision to go directly back to their base or detour. So it was very fateful that they decided that day to detour. Instead of going west back to their base, they went east to the new location of Radio Frankfurt. And was received well by Armed Forces Radio people there, and he made it understood that he was interested in this model. Went in, and they arranged for a technician to demonstrate it. They were ushered into a studio room with fairly good acoustics and an excellent loudspeaker system in it, and a roll of tape was put on the machine that was a direct recording from some German symphonic material, and Jack Mullen claims that it was one of the most impressive demonstrations he's ever had on the reproduction of recorded sound. And he was determined that he would find out more about how this was done. Well, it seems that the fellow officer with him was equipped with camera, and they spent the rest of that afternoon photographing all of the circuitry for this and all the detailed documentation that was available at the station. And when they got time, as soon as possible after returning in the months ahead, they converted a number of the machines that they had in their storeroom that had been held over from previous examination of the old type into high-frequency bias machines. And they were able to get results just as astounding as had been those of the demonstration at Radio Frankfurt. Finding out about these high-frequency bias machines explained a number of things to the people in our armed forces. They had been amazed at the number of places at which Hitler speeches would be coming from out of Germany. And in fact, there were rumors that there was more than one Hitler and such things as this, because one human being just couldn't possibly have been gotten from one place to the other so rapidly as these broadcasts indicated. Well, actually, it became plain to us and to our men when they found out the performance capability of this equipment, what had been going on. His speeches had been pre-recorded on tape and were taken to these various areas and released simply to, as a means of psychological warfare, to get our people confused. Also, they would use them in another way. There would be cities that had fair radio coverage stations that would be saturation bombed, in other words, just literally wiped off the face of the earth, and a few hours later, broadcasts would originate from there. Our radio compasses would pinpoint it exactly at the bombed out area. And what was happening, portable radio transmitters, field transmitters would be set up by the army, German army, and the tape material would be used for programming, and it appeared on our monitors to be live broadcast because the quality was so good. So Jack Mullen was determined that he was going to bring this kind of thing home to America when he got out of the service. So he got permission from his superior officer to send home some war souvenirs. Fortunately, the regulations with respect to sending home of war souvenirs were very lenient. I understand that they read something like this. The article to be sent home could not be a live bomb or hand grenade or shell or something that would endanger life or limb. But it did have to be small enough to fit within a standard U.S. mail bag, which was pretty generous, and it did have to have a weight limitation, which I think was 70 pounds, which was still quite generous. Well, nevertheless, the only way he figured how he could get these home, he had two machines that were made available to him and some parts and bits and pieces for others, was to dismantle these and pack them into smaller packages. It required 18 packages in all, and he sent these home over a period of many months. His family, his mother and father, lived in San Francisco, and these were addressed to their home, and I guess they were amazed at this constant stream of packages addressed to himself at their address. And these they carefully collected in the garage. So when he got out of the service, he came home and set to work on the task of reassembling these things. Now, mechanically, so far as the tape transport was concerned, he made little change in the device since it was pretty satisfactory for the most part. But he did make the conversions to the newer electronics that he had found in Frankfurt, including the AC bias, along with certain changes that he decided upon himself. He had had time to study the performance of the circuitry, so he came up with some improvements of his own. These were incorporated, so he ended up with two very fine machines. Now, about this time, he joined the company of William A. Palmer in San Francisco. Now, Bill Palmer was in the business of making 16-millimeter commercial advertising motion pictures of very high quality in color and with high quality soundtracks. So audio was a matter of considerable interest to him, especially high quality audio. So Jack's part of the business was to become responsible for the audio technology in the company, and right away he put to work these two German magnetophones. And this was perhaps the first application, certainly in the United States and perhaps in the world, where magnetic tape was used as a supporting means to the development of soundtracks on finished film products. This resulted in an even higher quality end result than Bill Palmer had been able to get by film recording and editing and dubbing means. Talent as demonstration material for this demonstration. And in an adjacent small studio, they had a musical combo that had been there for a rehearsal, and they performed a number of numbers which were picked up in the usual way by microphone, brought in and fed, first of all, directly to the power amplifier driving the loudspeaker so you could hear that for comparison, and then by means of a switch which had been set up, so-called A-B switch, we were able to listen to the same material as it came off the tape. Interestingly enough, he asked if anyone in that audience could ascertain which was the original and which was the reproduced sound. Several tried it, but they were embarrassed to find out they were wrong. It just wasn't possible. With the ears that were there, and I think there were some pretty good ones that assembled there that night. The other demonstration that was, I think, particularly impressive to people was he had a one-minute stretch of program material he had previously worked on, in which he had 60 splices in 1 minute time. That would be one splice a second. And no one could detect a single splice in that tape. At the end of the meeting, I went down and I introduced myself to him and asked if I might look at the machine a little more closely, which he permitted me to do. And just before leaving, I again complimented him on a very fine presentation and said, "I think no doubt your presentation here this evening will change the way of life of many people in this audience more than we may realize." I said, "I hope I may be one of those." He says, "Well, I hope so too. If the occasion should come up and I can be of help to you, do look me up." Well, little did either one of us realize at that moment that a few months hence that very thing would be happening, showing that you never can quite always tell what fate has in store for you or what may come of a particular event. So, getting back to the Ampex picture, I had been exposed to this in July of 46, and it was October of 46 that I had been called in to do the consulting with Mr. Poniatoff and the others at Ampex. And I still had the vivid impression in my mind of this unusual demonstration and the tremendous potential and possibilities of this new recording means. So, after hearing them out and investigating the directions they had in mind, I just couldn't, for example, couldn't see them going into studio turntables. There were already three or four outstanding producers of such equipment at that time on the market, and there wasn't really a very large market for such things. There just wasn't room for another company, especially a new and unknown one. So I thought to myself, do I dare suggest it? Well, finally, one day, I weakened and decided I'm going to suggest this and see how Mr. Poniatoff will react to it. So I said, "I have something that I've been hesitant to bring to your attention, but I feel we've reached the point in our discussion where it's now necessary that we discuss this." And I said, "I'm going to recommend to you that you look into the possibility of producing a domestic version of the German magnetophone." He said, "What is the German magnetophone?" So we had an explanation of that. When he learned of the Jack Mullen incident at the meeting, he said, "Why don't you call him up?" He says, "I'd like to meet him. I'd like to see the equipment." So I did just that, only to find that Jack Mullen was just ready to leave for Hollywood. He'd been asked down there by their IRE section to present a similar meeting for the engineering groups of that area. So Mr. Poniatoff decided to make hasty arrangements to go down and attend the meeting for the purposes of better acquainting himself with the capabilities of the equipment. This he did, and from what was related to me, I did not attend that meeting. It went off even more successfully than the San Francisco one, and he came back bubbling over with enthusiasm, saying, "This is the thing for us." He said, "I know it's a gamble. We don't have many resources. There's very little to fall back on. There's nothing in the literature on this subject." But he says, "Let's try it." So he fired the question to me, "Will you come to work for us full time to take responsibility for the project?" Well, after all the sales pitch I had been giving him and going this direction, I could hardly turn him down. Besides, I was delighted with the idea. So I phased out Dalma Victor as quickly as I could without prejudice, and I was able to get my work in pretty good shape in about 2 weeks, and so I didn't leave them in the lurch. And so I came to work full-time December 10th, 1946. Well, that was a happy day, but little did I realize, and little did the rest of us realize, the many pitfalls which lay ahead of us before success would finally be ours. I think had we even sensed for a moment some of these problems, we'd been so terrified and unnerved that we wouldn't have thought ever of attempting this thing. It would have been, anyone in their right mind would have said it was foolhardy to even go that way. Sometimes it helps not to be fully informed, you know. So we proceeded. Well, the first thing was to contact Jack Mullen. And I was anxious to see, because he was the individual I considered in this country, and perhaps one in the world, most informed in the subject of magnetic recording. Work was being done, of course, at Armour Institute by Marvin Kamaris, and there were many others in the field, but he had the most practical experience of anyone that I knew of, and practical experience we felt was paramount as a guide to us, because we wanted to make a practical recorder that was engineered to suit broadcast requirements, recording requirements, and was not a laboratory device, but an everyday working instrument. My question to him was much like this. I said, "Jack, what of the various areas of the machine, the transport, the electronics, and let's say the magnetic heads, what do you feel is the most critical and the most difficult to achieve success in?" He says, "There's no question in my mind," and he says, "the most mystifying part of this machine, and the thing that I know the least about," he said, "are the magnetic head." So he said, "I would sincerely suggest that you attempt to make a playback head, and if it turns out successful, go ahead and jump into the other areas of design. But failing that," he said, "my inclination would be to suggest that maybe you give the whole thing up as a bad thing to get into and think of some other direction." So we spent many months in designing, making some temporary tooling, and we did have a chance to examine the German heads, and we decided that there were things there that we, though we didn't fully understand all of them, we would like to venture to make some changes. So we not only, it wasn't a question of trying to make a Chinese copy, but we were venturing into a new field entirely with some new designs. So Jack suggested that when we finished this head, that we could bring it up to the W.A. Palmer Studios in San Francisco and try it out on the German machines, providing it was designed so it would be interchangeable with the head, so it wouldn't be too difficult to make the change. So We finally got the unit to the point where we felt it was ready for testing. We made an appointment, we went up there, and we had proportioned it so that it would be interchangeable, and it was a matter of a few minutes to remove the German playback head and put this in place. And we had, for test material, tape that had been used in the preparation of some of the film soundtracks in their regular work there. So we listened to this just before removing the German head, just to try and get an idea of what the tape was like. Then we made the transfer, put ours in place, and I can tell you that the moment before pushing that start button was one of the most breathless of my life, because we didn't know, would it or wouldn't it work? Surely the head showed electrical continuity. We had made what mechanical measurements we could on it, but was it going to work as a magnetic reproduced head? Well, I'm pleased to tell you that burst forth from the loudspeaker some of the most beautiful music we ever heard, because it outperformed the German head for some reason that, well, we probably realize it now. We had a better gap and a narrower gap, so its resolution was better. And our magnetic alloys we've taken particular pains with, and they contributed, no doubt, to this final result. But I can tell you, there was a lot of jumping in the air, hollering, shaking hands, patting one another in the back, and it seemed like a sort of a scaled-down New Year's Eve celebration there for a little bit. But that served, the impetus of this served to drive us on to the rest of the design. And it is most fortunate that that we had this early success. Failing this, I think we might have been sufficiently discouraged so that we would not have gone on. Now, I have a picture here, enlarged, of course, of that early head. For scale, the core width here is a little over a quarter of an inch, because that's what the tape width was at that time as it is today. Now, I might tell you that we had to make our own dies to punch the laminations, that they were punched on a small punch press, and that we had to make our own annealing furnace to do our hydrogen annealing, and we had shield cans, which do not show here. We had to draw those by using an automobile jack, hydraulic jack, to push the dies and draw out our cans and so forth. So it was strictly a handmade job. Of course, the taped surface and the contacting surface of the cores were all hand lapped. We had no equipment at that time. Well, this is the core here. These are the two windings around it, and here's the magnetic gap. Now, nowadays, you wouldn't be able to see that gap, and even in a photograph that large, because the gaps are so much more refined and smaller, but that was the case in those days.
What was the tape speed?
That's an interesting question. I'm happy you brought that up this time. One of our next questions, of course, tape speed didn't matter to us at that time because we were using somebody else's transport. But when we got into our transport, I said to Jack, what are your feelings about tape speed? I said, we're going to have to adopt something that's going to be reasonable, and we want to do this with due care. And he said, well, I feel that we really ought to look at the German speed. He said, I get very fine performance at this. And I said, by the way, didn't you say that tape speed was 76 centimeters a second, 76 and some tenths? He said, yes. And he said, why don't you match this? Well, it seemed to me that a metric speed didn't quite fit, and it should have, but it didn't fit our English system of measurements here. So I said, why don't we take the English equivalent of this and see what it is? So a reference to the conversion table showed that their tape speed converted to the English measurement turned out to be exactly 30 inches a second. And we said, how fortunate. We have an even number at least to work with. So we decided that would be the thing we would do. Now, he pointed out one great advantage to us. He said, this will enable you and ourselves to interchange tapes when we get to the operating point. He said, this may just prove very valuable. Now, as I go on in my story, you'll find out how that just about saved the day for Ampex later, the fact that we had adopted the same tape speed as the German machine. We, of course, set to work to design the other heads. The record head came next, and then finally the erase head we figured was the least critical. And then we started to work on the transport and, paralleling this, electronics. Jack would not let us look into the electronics of the equipment there, and we didn't find out several years later that he had made a commitment to a fellow who had also been in the service, a Colonel Richard Ranger of New Jersey. And he also learned of the magnetophone from Jack went back to Europe to find out all he could, went back to Germany about it, came back to this country and decided that he would make a, what we might call an oriental copy of the magnetophone. Well, I'd like to point out an interesting thing. He had maybe every advantage over ourselves at Ampex because he had more information. But there were two differences in philosophy, of design philosophy. In our case at Ampex, we decided that we wouldn't make a Chinese copy. We would study very carefully what we had been exposed to, try and decide why the Germans had done each thing on the recorder, each part, designed it as they did, and if we could think of a possible way of improving it, venture to try that, even though it might be risky. It might embody throwing ourselves a curve later that we didn't realize. We realized there was greater risk in this, but also if we succeeded, we could come up with a better machine. On the other hand, Colonel Richard Ranger decided to make it as nearly a Chinese copy as it could be. In fact, it looked very, very similar to the German machine, which, by the way, is here, and I'll pass this around, and then I'll have a better picture in a few moments here to show you.
Yes. The course left, we're supposed to finish around 4.
All right. I'll move it right along. Thank you. I wasn't even looking at that clock. I'm sorry.
I'm sure nobody else was. And I, by prearrangement, am supposed to take them clear through up until the space age today.
Well, I've sort of been infringing on your time here, I'm afraid. Nevertheless, the Ranger tone, as his unit was called, really never quite made it in the industry. He got a few of them into Hollywood because he had a development in it which was unique, that they could be synchronized with film, and it made it useful for the film people. But we went on a different tack that we'll try and improve the design and make a better device from the human engineering standpoint. Here are the two units down in Hollywood. Jack later went down to save the day with Crosby. I won't be able to give you the whole story, but Bing Crosby got himself in a bit of trouble with his program. His Hooper rating was slipping, his popularity, and it was found out that it was because of dubbing from disc to disc. And that was the only kind of editing they could do to prepare his program. He liked to perform extemporaneously and then go on the air transcribe, which left a lot of editing to do, but it gave him freedom at the time of doing his program, which he liked very much. Doing it on disc was difficult because they ended up with so many dubs and redubs that they developed distortions, and people were not liking to listen to this kind of program. So they, some of his technical people, heard the presentation in Hollywood at the IRE down there, called upon Jack Mullen, got him down there. He started to a program. They tried some tests of doing a show on tape, and it was successful. So he did 27 weeks of Crosby shows. This showed the broadcast field that tape was here to stay. Well, then Amtex came along, and here is the test in the same room of our first recorder. And the thing that saved the day is just before our machine was to go down there, our recording circuit developed problems and we could not record. So we called Jack in desperation, what shall we do? He says, don't let on, it won't record. He says, we'll just demonstrate it on playback. He says, we'll use Crosby tapes. Well, they were at the same tape speed, 30 inches a second, so they worked. The azimuth may have been off a little, but our machine provided azimuth adjustment, which we were able to make in a matter of minutes, and we had excellent reproduction. Crowds of engineers went through all day long through this area where you see the machine, having demonstrations in groups, and then the next one would come along. And then that whole day, no one asked us, please make a recording for us. I can tell you we were nearly exhausted at the end of the day from anxiety. That got us in the business. Following that came an order for 24 machines from ABC, which Crosby acquired. We found ourselves in the embarrassing position that we had no money to buy the parts to make the 24 machine. And this information somehow or other, through the grapevine, got back to Bing Crosby, and in the return mail, without any strings attached, no security, came a check, a personal check from Bing Crosby for the amount of $50,000. That is what got us started. And following that, the publicity, and I don't think this will even stand holding up, but here is the San Mateo Times, Thursday, December 18th, 1947, Bing Crosby signs big San Carlos deal. Here he is, quite a bit younger than we're used to seeing today, takes over full output of new recording device. That was the beginning. Up till that time, a bank wouldn't give us a second look. And very often I meet some of those bankers and in fun kind of joke about that, and they don't take too kindly to it. It's a little embarrassing to them today. Anyway, finally from that stage, we got on to the covers of magazines, and the machines were used by ABC for many months on their daylight saving time program in 1948. They were out of some 3,000 and some hours. There were only 3 minutes of time off the air because of Ampex equipment malfunction, which set something of a record for performance for broadcast equipment. Well, from there on, our success was assured. But there were many a struggle. There was many a struggle. Times without paychecks, working around the clock, and all of these things I'm sure many of you are familiar with who have put a company together. So what started out from the innocent matter of attending an IRE meeting finally developed into a multi-million dollar corporation and set the pace for a whole new way of life in broadcasting, recording, and even in television, and finally in instrumentation and data recording. That's about the best I can do in a short run. That is Jack Mullen when he had all of his hair. He's now bald as a billiard ball. And
he has a beard.
And a beard, too. And the gentleman on the right is Myrtle McKenzie, who was the technical producer for the Crosby shows.
I'll send those.
All right. Well, I'm sorry to have had to cut this short, but we started a little late, and normally it takes me about almost 2 hours to give the full story. But for a quickie, I think this will have to do.
I think it's done very well. We really appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure, and thank you for your kind attention.
In the books there, the copy of Electronics in the West, the first 50 years, the rest of the story as to how Charles B. Ginsburg developed video tape recording and even color video tape recording. And that's all in the chapter called Magnetic Recording Will Never Have a Future. Are there any questions you'd like to ask Mr. Lindsay before he gets off the platform here?
Could you ask the question so that he can repeat it so we can all hear it?
Yes.
We use the term azimuth adjustment a few minutes before the last minute. What is that?
It's the tilt of the magnetic gap with respect to the axis of travel of the tape. It should, ideally in the industry, everyone tries to establish a 90-degree angle. That's standard. So that you have interchangeability from one make a recorder to another or from one machine.
Oh, I see.
Yes?
What does the recorder work on, electricity or battery?
Well, the early machines were all AC operated from the power line. We didn't get into battery operated devices till much later.
Were the Germans the first to have the magnetic tape?
Yes, actually the original patent, if we go back to, of course the idea of magnetic recording goes back to 1898 to Poulsen, the Danish physicist, who actually made the first machine that worked, sans electronic aid, which is very remarkable. He had no electronic tubes then to help him. So there was no amplification available, yes.
One thing I wasn't clear on, you said that when Crosby recorded the first thing, it was 20 tapes. Were they on FX equipment or were they on?
No, they were done on the German magnetophone.
Okay.
His main concern is, well, here it works, but how are we, can we get other machines? Because there were no more German machines available.
The ones that didn't have the final improvements.
Well, I don't know what the status of those were in this country, but I don't think many of them were brought over. Yes.
Where was wire all
this time? Well, first wire came before this. It came in the early recordings were done in the early 20s and 30s. But wire was carried right up into wartime. Actually, our military people used wire recorders. And it had certain weaknesses, of course. Yes?
When you're talking about recorders.
Which recorders? The Ampex recorders?
Yeah.
Well, I was responsible for the design of the first two models, the Model 200, and then succeeded by a smaller machine, the Model 300. With my first, no one did it single-handedly. I can't take credit for this. I had a crew of people helping me. We were very small at first, but we were able to do the job long hours. Yes.
Wasn't there a system of recording use and broadcast? I think either the late 20s and early 30s where a stylus cut a groove in a band of wax that was passed over a photocell?
They cut, this was a variable area recording and it was done on opaque film.
Mm-hmm.
And when the stylus cut through, it opened up the took off the coating so that light would transmit, and then it was a variable area.
When exactly was that used?
It was in the 30s. And then there was the Blattner phone, which was a steel ribbon. That was used by the British Broadcasting Company for a number of years.
Was that magnetic?
It was magnetic, but solid steel ribbon. Went at a terrifying speed. I'd hate to be in the room with the machine while it was rewinding.